Who? I said.
Errol Flynn, the actor.
At least, he thinks it's acting.
I shook my head. Never mind, she said. I've been trying to write Mr. Rochester's dialogue all day, and every time he speaks, he sounds like Errol Flynn. It's driving me crazy. She looked at the packages of groceries I was putting away. What kind of ice cream did I order? She said.
Pistachio, I said.
Pistachio?
I took it out of the grocery bag and showed her.
I hate pistachio, she said. I would never have ordered pistachio. It's green.
That's what Mr. Spicer packed. Mrs. Windermere raised an eyebrow.
Skinny delivery boy. Mr. Spicer is not infallible.
I shrugged. She looked at the pistachio ice cream.
Go get 2 spoons, she said, and take off that jacket. I don't want to write with Errol Flynn, and I don't want to eat ice cream with him either, even if it is only pistachio.
When I got to the library that afternoon, Mr. Powell and Lil were already upstairs, and Lil had a stack of books that, she said, she got out for both of us because we were supposed to be working on a project about New Zealand for Mr. Barber, and did I remember that we were partners and the project was due in 2 weeks? I'm not a chump. I said I remembered. Then Mr. Powell said I looked great in my flight jacket. Lil said I looked great, too. Only the way she said it made it sound a whole lot better than the way Mr. Powell said it. She smiled and opened up one of the books on New Zealand. You know how pretty someone can be when she opens up a book? Especially if she has brown hair the color of the pelican's feathers.
Mr. Swiatek, said Mr. Powell, and we got to work.
Balance can be achieved in 2 different kinds of conditions, said Mr. Powell. Stable and unstable.
Stable and unstable, I said.
Let's say that you were going to draw Lil sitting by that table, working on the project that you better get going on as soon as we're done here. Let's say that we draw the table with its legs on the floor, and Lil with her feet on the floor. And maybe the drawing will be wider than it is high, so we can show the whole table.
That painting would be stable. Why?
Because nothing would look like it could fall over, I said.
Exactly.
A stable composition is fixed firmly to the ground.
So, in an unstable composition, I could have Lil floating away to New Zealand.
Lil smirked at me.
Yes, said Mr. Powell.
What else?
Maybe the table could be slanted and the right legs up in the air.
In such a painting, do you see how much more tension there would be? Said Mr. Powell.
You don't know where anything is headed.
The brown pelican is stable, I said. And after a moment, Mr. Powell said,
Yes, he is.
He is, you know. It might look like he isn't, standing mostly on this one leg on a curved branch that looks pretty rotten. But he is. He wouldn't move if a hurricane blew in. That's what makes him so noble. I drew the forked-tailed petrels again, from scratch, because that's what Mr. Powell said I needed to do. They weren't smiling. The water was going every which way beneath them. And the wind was a storm blowing so bad they could hardly control their wings.
You sure can't tell where they're headed, said Mr. Powell.
And he was right.
Afterward, I got to work on the New Zealand project, alone, since Lil left because she had a stomach ache. But she made sure to leave all the books with bookmarks at the right places. She could hardly wait to see what I came up with, she said from the stairs.
Terrific.
The first day of April was a gray and half-rainy day that still thought it was early March. After school, Lil and I walked over to the Ballard paper mill to bring Mr. Ballard a note for my mother about the orchid, and to maybe throw a few horseshoes. You know how good a flight jacket feels on a cold day like this? You know how good it felt walking with Lil to throw horseshoes, even though it was half rainy? Even though everyone in stupid Marysville thought Christopher was... I went into Mr. Ballard's office, and he was talking with Mrs. Stenson, and when he saw us, he called, "My partner!" And I introduced him to Lil, and they shook hands. I gave him my mother's note, and he said thanks, and he hoped that my mother liked the orchid. I told him that she turned it every morning in the sun, so that it would grow evenly, and when she watered it, it was like she was feeding a baby. He laughed and asked if we wanted to throw some horseshoes, and Lil said we did. And I got the shoes from behind the door, and by the time I turned around, Lil was picking out an orchid for herself, and the sun had come out suddenly and was throwing everything it could through that window, and it was all landing on Lil. And she was smiling and brushing her hair back the way she does, and being kind of embarrassed because Mr. Ballard was giving her this orchid that was almost as beautiful as she was, a pale purple one with white just barely on its edges. She looked at me and smiled, holding the orchid. "What do you think?" she said. "Beautiful," I said. We left the orchid and went out of the office and across the mill floor. The sun was still shining when we opened the door, and some of the people on the floor gasped when they saw the light pouring through. "Leave it open," someone said, and we did. We went outside, and there, standing against the wall, I guess on another break, were my father and Ernie Echo. They were smoking and laughing like something was really, really funny. The funniest thing in the whole world. And Ernie Echo? Ernie Echo was wearing... My father said, "What are you doing here?" I didn't even look at him. Ernie Echo was wearing my Yankee jacket from Joe Pepitone. Lil and I went back inside. We walked across the floor. I left the horseshoes outside Mr. Ballard's office door. Lil took my hand. "You better go in and get your orchid," I said. "I don't..." "Go ahead," I said. She waited for a bit. Then she bent down to pick up the horseshoes and went on inside. I was gone before she came out. I didn't want her to see me. I ran. Hard. Really hard. Until I hurt so bad that it didn't matter that the world was so unstable. And it didn't even matter that maybe I was wrong. When the hurricane blew in, it would throw the brown pelican as far as it wanted to. Ernie Echo didn't come to supper that night. My mother asked if I'd seen Mr. Ballard and given him the note. I said yes. The orchid was in the middle of the table, and every so often she would reach across and turn it so that she could look at it from a different angle, like she was studying its balance. I didn't say much the whole meal. Neither did my father. At dessert, Lucas said he thought it was about time he should be looking for work. Christopher said he could help him get around if he could cut school, and my mother slapped at him, and Christopher said he should get credit for trying, and Lucas told him he'd get by, and Christopher wasn't allowed to miss a day, not a single day, and Christopher said, "How come?" And Lucas got real quiet and said, almost whispered, "Because you're not going to Vietnam. You're going to college." And my father said there wasn't any way in the whole world he was going to pay for that, and Lucas said that was why he was getting a job. And my father said he wasn't going to get a job, because what could he do? Which pretty much ended dessert. There's a kind of angry quiet that can lie down over a house. Maybe there are some houses, like the Dohertys, that have never known it. That house probably hasn't ever had a quiet day. But in the dump, angry quiet was an old friend, and he moved in again. No one talked, because we all wanted to scream. Lucas started going out every morning to look for work. You know how many people in stupid Marysville want to hire someone who doesn't have legs? Zero. He went out in that stupid wheelchair every day the first week of April. Every day. He wheeled himself up and down every street in Marysville that had some place where someone might get work. You know how hard it is to go down a stupid curb in a wheelchair? You know how hard it is to get back up on the other side before a light turns red again? You know how many stores even have doors that Lucas could figure out how to open while sitting in a wheelchair? Here's what they told Lucas. I don't think you could do this job from a wheelchair. Sorry, but I couldn't put up with a contraption like that rattling around here all day.
It'd be too hard on you, son.
The aisles are too small for your wheelchair. You'd never manage. Frankly, we don't want our customers feeling sorry about something when they walk in. People who know they're going to feel sorry don't come back to the store. And more like that. But Lucas went out every day. I guess being in a wheelchair can be pretty unstable. But Lucas isn't. Do you know what it feels like to walk into a house where everything is going along just fine? When back at your own house, Lucas is going out every day for nothing, and Ernie Echo is wearing your jacket? That's what it was like the next Wednesday night when I went to the Dohertys on short notice again, and Mrs. Doherty said, "Thanks for coming, Doug," and told me there were marshmallow brownies for me after the kids were in bed, but they had already had theirs, and they didn't need any more sugar, which I could tell, because Phronsie and Davy had me by the legs, and Joel was trying to push me over, and Polly and Ben were waiting to see if I was going to fall over so they could pounce. "Don't hurt him," Mrs. Doherty said, and Mr. Doherty said I was big enough to take it, and he laughed. And that was the cue, I guess, for Ben and Polly, because I was down on the floor before Mr. and Mrs. Doherty were out the door, and they were tickling me until I agreed to play Bloody Bloody Murderer, and they all went screaming to hide. When I found Davy, I tagged him, and he became a Bloody Bloody Murderer too. And then we went into the kitchen and found Polly, and she became a Bloody Bloody Murderer too. And then we went... Well, I guess you can figure out the rules. And after that, we all had some cold milk, and I let them have just a tiny piece of marshmallow brownie. And then we started in on the reading, which, as you might remember, takes a while. Phronsie had a new book, and I don't care what anyone says, elephants don't wear clothes. Davy made me read about this kid who had a name like Tick-Tock Tiddlywink Tembe, something that I could never read right, and Joel just about died laughing when I tried, and you couldn't do it either. Joel had a book about Ben that he thought was great because he had a brother Ben, and this Ben could figure out how to jump to the top of the castle, and could I guess how he did it? "You can't jump to the top of a castle," I said. And Joel started to laugh and laugh and laugh because you can too, so go ahead and read it. Polly had this book about a house in a forest where Laura lives with Pa and Ma and her sisters. You'd be surprised how good this was.
especially considering that nothing happens. And Ben had this book about a pig that went to Florida, and it turned out to be funnier than it sounds, which was good, because there are a whole lot of books with this pig, could I believe it? And Ben wanted to read every single one. Terrific. So by the time the pig got on his way and all the kids got to bed, it was probably later than the Dohertys would have wanted it to be, but it usually was. And I was sitting in the upstairs hall listening to everything settle into that kind of sweet and beautiful breathing. Mrs. Verne had given us more quadratic equations than she should have for advanced algebra, and then four problems about two men who were driving in different directions at different speeds for different amounts of time, and who cares how far apart they could get before one of them ran out of gas. And then the breathing wasn't sweet and beautiful anymore. It was wheezing from Joel's room. Breathing like the breather couldn't get enough air. I stood up, wheezing hard and kind of desperate. I went in, turned on the light. Joel was looking at me, and his eyes. Oh, God. I had seen the black-backed gull. I run to his bed, and he tries to breathe. He can hardly get anything in. His eyes get bigger. He tries drawing more air in. Hardly anything. I run into the hall. I call home. Christopher answers. I tell him to get over here now and hang up. I run into Joel. Hardly anything. Run to Ben's room and tell him I have to take Joel to Dr. Bottom's house, and he should stay awake with the others until Christopher comes. Is it his asthma? He says. I don't know, I say. I run into Joel. He is standing by the bed with his back arched, dragging in air, rubbing at his chest, starting to cry. Sweaty. Ben runs in. Where's your inhaler? Joel, where's your inhaler? Joel looks at me like he thinks I can do something. Ben starts tearing the bed apart, and then he runs to the nightstand and pulls out the drawer and empties it on the bed. I can't find it, he yells. Joel, where is your inhaler? Polly comes and stands by the door. She looks at Joel. Is he going to die? She says. I wrap him in a blanket. I carry him downstairs and out the door. Joel puts his arms around me, tight, like he is fighting a bloody, bloody murderer. Start to run. Do you know what it feels like, running in the night, holding this kid who's crying, but he can't cry because he can't breathe? And you're running and running, and you don't know if it's your sweat or his, and he's staring at you, afraid, and believing in you, but you're not believing in you. And if the Bottoms aren't home, what are you going to do then? Running in the night, running in the night, running in the night, running. Their lights are on. I kick at the door as hard as I can. Again. 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 Joel drags another breath, weaker now. Again. The door opens. Dr. Bottom, I hope. One look at us. And he reaches out and he takes Joel. Otis, Otis, get the shower running. Hot as you can get it. Now. Carries Joel into the living room and looks at me and points to another room where he wants me to get something. And then sees that I probably can't figure out what he wants. And he tells me to hold Joel. And he runs and then he comes back with this thing and he hollers, here. And he holds it out and Joel grabs it and holds it to his mouth and pumps. And pumps. And pumps. And pumps. And I can hear the air dragging in, but it's less draggy. And Joel, who is starting to turn a color that no human being should turn, but I didn't want to tell you about that until you knew it was going to be all right. Joel looks at me, and he smiles. Keeps pumping. breathing, breathing, sweet, beautiful breathing, beautifully. Dr. Bottom carries him to the stairs. Then he looks back at me. "I'm going to bring him up into the steam for a bit," he says. He looks down at Joel, breathing, watching me. "Do you know what he's telling you?" I shook my head. Dr. Bottom smiled. "I think you do." I did. It's the same thing that Mr. and Mrs. Daugherty told me when they got to Dr. Bottom's house and saw Joel asleep on the couch, covered with two Afghans and being watched over by Dr. Bottom and Otis and me. And by the way, Otis made the coffee for us that night, and for the record, it was a whole lot stronger than Mrs. Windermere's. I guess he was used to making coffee that helps people stay awake. Maybe he's a good guy, too. Mrs. Daugherty stayed the night at Dr. Bottom's house, so she would be there when Joel woke up. Mr. Daugherty drove me home. Then he went back for Christopher and drove him home. When Christopher came up into our bedroom, I was still awake and sitting on his bed. "So how did it go?" I said. "This is what he told me. Piece of cake." "Really?" "Really." "They didn't..." "Hey, I'm not some chump babysitter. I told them all to go to bed, and they did. That's it. Get off my bed and go to sleep." "Shut up, or I'm coming over there and kick you both to death." You can guess who said that. I went by the Daugherty's house the next morning. Joel was great. And here's what Mrs. Daugherty told me. When they got home, they saw Ben and Polly holding Christopher down on the floor, and Davy and Phronsie were beating him around the head with one hand and holding a marshmallow brownie with the other. And Christopher was begging for mercy. And when he saw the Daugherty's, he picked up Davy and Phronsie, who were still beating at him but not letting go of their marshmallow brownies, and he told Mr. and Mrs. Daugherty where Joel was, and they got into the car right away and hadn't even thought about telling the children to go to bed. Piece of cake. After school, Mr. Daugherty was waiting with his patrol car. When he saw me, he waved, told me to come over. He opened the side door and I got in. And he said he was going to drive me home to thank me. And he put the siren on, and off we went. And here's what Mr. Daugherty told me. The night before, when he got back to the house to pick up Christopher after he'd brought me home, my brother was in a heap of little Daugherty's, all asleep on top of him. And he was asleep, too. And still holding the book about elephants who wear clothes. I'm not lying. That's what Mr. Daugherty told me. Don't tell my brother I know this. Don't tell him that I know he's not a chump babysitter. And don't tell him that I think he may be what the brown pelican is. Chapter 9. The Great Eskimo Curlew. Plate 237. It took a while, but by the first Saturday of May, spring finally decided to stick around. Mr. Leffler said it was the latest spring he'd ever seen, but that probably meant it would be the warmest, and he was right. I didn't even need my flight jacket anymore, which didn't mean that I stopped wearing it. By that first Saturday, everything had jumped from brown to green, and if you stood in front of the Marysville Free Public Library and looked at the maples up and down the street, you could watch their gold leaves unfurl like little flags, waving for all they were worth, which,
after a long winter was a lot. I pulled the Saturday deliveries past people dragging last year's leaves from under their bushes, cutting back hedges, digging up gardens by the curbs, and raking, raking, raking like the Marysville garden inspector was going to stop by in the afternoon. It was that kind of a day. Back at Spicer's Deli, I told Lil that everything looked as green as New Zealand, and she said, "How would you know?" Which I think meant that I hadn't exactly done half of the work for Mr. Barber's New Zealand project that we handed in together. But I'm no chump. "I'll buy you a Coke and show you how green it is," I said. "Does that mean I'm supposed to go get Cokes for the two of us?" I shook my head. I took 2 quarters out of my pocket and laid them on the deli counter. Lil chinged open the register and slid them into the drawer. And I went over to the refrigerator and back and got 2 bottles of Coke, took their caps off, and brought them up front. There was froth at the tops of the bottles, and Lil could hardly keep from giggling when she took her first sip. "It always goes up my nose," she said. She was beautiful. She walked with me to Mrs. Windermere's, and I'm not lying. Everything was even greener than it had been in town when I was making deliveries earlier that morning. By a lot. The maples, the oaks, the grass, the ferns coming up beside the road, the fields, especially the fields, which even smelled green. "You were right," said Lil. She took my hand, and we walked up to Mrs. Windermere's, slowly. It was still too short. At the house, there was a car I hadn't seen before, about a block and a half long. It was so long that it didn't fit in the turnaround. Half of it was on the grass, gleaming everywhere. We went to the back, and I unlocked the door with the so-secret key, and Lil and I brought the groceries in and put them all away, and we started out because we had the whole slow walk back to look forward to. And then Mrs. Windermere came in with Mr. I Own the Gleaming Car next to her. "Skinny delivery boy," she said. "Mrs. Windermere," I said, "do you think that maybe you could call me something else?" "No." "Is everything put away already?" "Yep. We were just going." I reached for Lil's hand. "And this is?"
"Lillian Spicer," said Lil. "It's nice to meet you, Lillian."
"Thank you," said Lil. "It's very nice to meet you." She was always so polite. Did I tell you that she has green eyes? Did I tell you that she's beautiful?
"So is Lillian your girlfriend?"
said Mrs. Windermere. Everything stopped. Everything.
"Skinny delivery boy, you know I never beat around the bush. Yes or no?"
I looked at Lil. She looked at me. She wasn't planning to be helpful with this. I looked back at Mrs. Windermere.
"Yes," I said.
I looked back at Lil, smiling.
"Mrs. Windermere," said Mr. I Own the Gleaming Car. "And this," said Mrs. Windermere, "is Mr. Gregory, who is supposed to be producing my play at the end of the month, but who is not making much headway."
"Who is making the best headway any producer could possibly make with a writer who is," started Mr. Gregory.
"Mr. Gregory likes strawberry ice cream," said Mrs. Windermere.
"I do not like strawberry ice cream," said Mr. Gregory.
"Nonsense," said Mrs. Windermere. "Everybody likes strawberry ice cream. What kind did I order?"
"Raspberry sherbet," said Lil.
"Oh, dear," said Mrs. Windermere. She shook her head. "That's too bad."
"Raspberry sherbet?" said Mr. Gregory.
We all sat down to small bowls of raspberry sherbet, except for Mr. Gregory, who sat down to a bowl of raspberry sherbet about as big as New Zealand, because he hadn't had raspberry sherbet since he was a boy, and he thought he should make up for lost time. I think he might be a good guy. At least, he looked like he might be a good guy. You can't look like Mr. I Own the Gleaming Car when you're eating a huge bowl of raspberry sherbet in someone's kitchen.
So, are all the actors ready for the play? Said Lil.
That's the problem, said Mrs. Windermere. Mr. Gregory hasn't cast them all yet. You have no idea how difficult it is to find actors for as many parts as we need played for this script, said Mr. Gregory. If only a certain writer had been willing to...
A certain writer won't, said Mrs. Windermere.
Who do you still need?
Helen Burns, to start with, said Mr. Gregory.
Helen Burns, said Mrs. Windermere slowly. To start with, said Mr. Gregory. Mrs. Windermere looked at Lil.
There she is right there. Skinny delivery boy's girlfriend.
Mr. Gregory looked at Lil.
I'm not an actor, said Lil.
No, you would be an actress, said Mrs. Windermere. And Lillian, every young girl, once she steps upon a Broadway stage, enjoys the thrill of being an actress.
Not me, said Lil.
The right voice, the right manner, even the right hair.
I think she'd be perfect, said Mr. Gregory. How old are you?
I'm 25, said Lil.
Have you ever acted before? Said Mr. Gregory.
Lil stood up. No, and I won't be acting now.
She's really, really good, I said.
Lil looked at me like she was going to throw the rest of her raspberry sherbet in my face.
Really? I said.
Lil looked back at Mr. Gregory. She smiled sweetly, sort of. Then she pointed at me.
Do you have a part for him? She said.
Mr. Gregory shook his head.
No,
he said. Not for a young boy.
I smiled at Lil sweetly. Sort of.
Perhaps the voice of Bertha Mason, said Mrs. Windermere.
The voice of Bertha Mason? I said.
Can you shriek like an insane woman who has been locked in an attic for a great many years? Said Mrs. Windermere.
I've heard Doug shriek like that lots of times, said Lil. I looked at her. She smiled even more sweetly.
No,
I said. Lil looked at Mr. Gregory and shrugged. If he won't shriek like an insane woman who has been locked in an attic for a great many years, then I won't be Helen Burns.
Then you're not Helen Burns, I said.
Fine, she said.
Fine, I said. I sure did wish we had gotten out of that kitchen as soon as we put the deliveries away.
Then that's that, said Mrs. Windermere.
That's that, I said.
I'll see you next week, skinny delivery boy, said Mrs. Windermere.
I'll see you next week, I said.
Fine,
she said.
Fine, I said. Lil and I dropped our bowls and spoons into the sink, and we went to the door.
Goodbye, Mr. Gregory, Lil said.
And that was the mistake. She shouldn't have stopped to say goodbye. It's like those horror movies where the person about to be mauled to death could have saved herself if she'd taken only one more step, but she stops to be polite or something. I took Lil's hand. We were almost through the door.
Gregory, said Mrs. Windermere loudly. What have you done with the snowy heron I gave you?
I stopped.
I've already told you. I haven't done a thing with it. I hate birds.
and I hate pictures of birds.
I wonder if we might find a better place for it than rolled up and put away in your closet.
I turned around. Such as? Said Mr. Gregory.
The snowy heron, I said.
Mrs. Windermere turned to me.
Yes, she said.
She turned back to Mr. Gregory.
I wonder if we might make a present of it to someone.
The snowy heron? I said again. Audubon's snowy heron?
Excuse me, skinny delivery boy.
Yes.
We could make a present of it to someone who, say, helped out in the performance.
Mrs. Windermere cupped her chin in her hand.
Just a thought, she said.
I looked at Lil. Helen Burns is a great part, I said.
Wait a minute, said Lil.
Why don't we all sit down and have another bowl of raspberry sherbet, said Mrs. Windermere.
You remember the snowy heron, right? If you saw the snowy heron, if you saw how beautiful the snowy heron was, if you saw how perfect he looks in Audubon's book, then you would be willing to shriek like an insane woman who has been locked in an attic for a great many years, too. You would. It took more than a little bit of convincing to get Lil to be Helen Burns, which really is a great part, even though she dies. You might wonder how I finally convinced her. It happened on Monday, in geography. When Mr. Barber announced that we were going to be doing one more team project for the year, it was going to be on the role of transportation in a country's development. And when Mr. Barber asked, "Who would like to do the Transcontinental Railroad in the United States?" Lil raised her hand and said that she would do it with me.
"Is that okay with you, Douglas?" said Mr. Barber.
Lil looked at me and mouthed the words, Helen Burns.
Terrific, I said.
You might wonder who is going to have to do almost everything on this project because one of us has a real part in a Broadway play with real lines, while the other one just has to stand off stage and scream like an insane woman who has been locked in an attic for a great many years, and that same one of us did diddly on the New Zealand project, and so the one with the real part in the Broadway play figures that the one without a real part in the Broadway play has a lot to make up for. I'm starting to feel like a chump. But whenever I feel like a chump, I remember the snowy heron. If you saw the snowy heron. When Mr. Barber found out about the Broadway play, he said that since Lil and I were going to be working so hard to put on this play, we only had to turn in a 500-word report on the Transcontinental Railroad. I didn't look at Lil when Mr. Barber said this. She couldn't have been smiling, but I was. When Mr. McElroy found out about the Broadway play, he wanted to take a whole period talking about the role of actors in world history. But the only actor that any of us could think of was John Wilkes Booth.
I guess actors aren't so important after all, said Mr. McElroy.
You can't imagine an actor ever becoming president of the United States, for example, which was true. We couldn't. When Mrs. Verne found out about the Broadway play, she took a whole period off from solving equations with at least two unknowns to talk about her own college acting career, which had a whole lot of lines in Greek that she could still recite and which I'm not going to write here because I don't even know how. When Miss Cowper found out about the Broadway play, I thought she was going to walk on air right there in front of us. She said that she hadn't heard such good news in a long time.
We would have to stop the introduction to poetry unit prematurely, she said, and move directly into the modern drama unit so that the class could support Lillian and Douglas. Would we please pass forward our poetry anthologies? I'm not lying. The whole class loved us. You can only take so much poetry, especially when it's poetry by Percy Bysshe Shelley, who is still going to get it right in the face someday. When Coach Reed found out about the Broadway play, he smiled and said he wasn't surprised. Maybe he's turning into a good guy, too. When Mr. Ferris found out about the Broadway play, Clarence didn't stop rocking during the whole lab, which involved sulfur, which is something you really don't want to smell like, but which we all did by the time we were finished. But Mr. Ferris promised we wouldn't smell like that by the time the curtain came up. And when Mr. Powell heard about the Broadway play, he went over to Birds of America and turned pages until he came to the one he wanted. "Look at this one," he said. We did. "The Great Eskimo Curlew. An actor, if ever there was one." He was right. The Great Eskimo Curlew looked like he was just coming on stage, his body leaning forward, his neck stretched out, his bill stuck up in the air like he was about to sing or something. The composition was stable, with his body right in the center against a mound of grasses, also in the center. And the only thing that upset all this was his bill, which you looked at first because it seemed to stick out above the scenery, and it was upside down. "Am I supposed to look like that when I come on stage?" said Lil. "I'm no chump." I didn't say a thing. On Tuesday and Friday evenings and Saturday afternoons for the rest of May, Mr. Spicer drove Lil and me down into New York City and dropped us off at the Rose Theater, where Mr. Gregory was always standing outside waiting for us and making it look like we were late. On the drive down, Lil went over her Helen Burns lines again and again, and again and again. "Miss Scatcherd is hasty. You must take care not to offend her." "Do you think it's Scatcherd or Scatcherd?" she said. "Scatcherd," I said. She tried it out. She tried it out again. "Scatcherd," she said. That's how it was pretty much the whole way down to New York City. And just so everyone knows the stats, number of times I repeated Lil's lines with her, something over 6,000. Number of times I had to correct her, something over 60,000. Number of times we drove to New York City before I had all her lines down myself, 6. Number of times she asked me to say my lines, 0. Which is probably because she didn't want me shrieking like an insane woman who has been locked in an attic for a great many years while we were locked inside a car. And I'm not lying. I was a great shrieker. I'd been practicing, too. If you're going to get this right, you can't just shriek. Anyone can do that. To shriek like an insane woman who has been locked in an attic for a great many years, you have to practice. The first time I practiced was in our bathroom, and when Lucas heard it, he tried to roll his wheelchair right up the stairs because he figured there was a bloody, bloody murderer at my throat. He got 3 steps up before I heard him. After that, he said I had to practice outside. So I went to the green field on the way to Mrs. Windermere's house and hoped that no one was around. "Here's how you practice shrieking like an insane woman who has been locked in an attic for a great many years. You stand in the middle of the field. You look around to be sure that no one is going to hear you. You breathe in a couple of times to get as much air into your chest as you can. You stretch your neck up like the Great Eskimo Curlew. You imagine that it's Game 7 of the World Series, and it's the bottom of the ninth, and Joe Pepitone is rounding third base, and the throw is coming in, and the catcher has his glove up waiting for the ball, and Joe Pepitone is probably going to be out, and the game will be over, and the Yankees will lose. Then you let out your shriek, because that's how everyone in Yankee Stadium would be shrieking right then. That's how you practice shrieking like an insane woman who has been locked in an attic for a great many years. And you keep doing it over and over again until all the birds in Marysville have flown away. I'm not lying. I got good at this. If you had heard me shrieking, you would have thought someone was being murdered too. It was so eerie, you might have thought that someone who had been murdered was shrieking. You might even have thought that someone who had been murdered had come back and was murdering the murderer who was shrieking. That's how good I was. When the cast of Jane Eyre heard me shriek from offstage for the very first time, they all looked around to see who had done it, and then they started clapping. That's pretty good. Lil said I was a natural. It hardly sounded like I was acting at all. And how was I doing on the Transcontinental Railroad in the United States? Mr. Gregory said I might have to tone it down a bit, since we didn't want people in the first two rows fainting away. Mrs. Windermere said I might have to tone it down a bit, since we didn't want people in the first two rows wetting their pants. It got so that I liked the rehearsals, even though it meant that I couldn't be drawing the Great Eskimo Curlew with Mr. Powell on Saturday afternoons. But I loved watching Lil on stage. I loved listening to her lines, which, as you might remember, I already knew by heart. It was, for the record, Scatcherd, and I didn't say anything, even after Mr. Gregory had to correct her for the third time. And I loved when Lil looked out into the seats to see if I was watching her, which I always was. In May, Lucas was hired for three stupid jobs. You can imagine how that felt. And you can imagine how it felt when he got fired from all three stupid jobs. The first time was from the Gulf Station, and it wasn't his fault. Things started out all right, but then there were three stupid days of stupid rain in a row. When people drove up to get gas, Lucas would wheel out from the garage as quick as he could. He'd come around to the door to find out how much gas they wanted, then wheel around to the pump and pump it. Then come back around to the door to get the money. Then wheel back to the garage to get their change in their genuine crystal goblet, since Gulf was running a special. By then, he was pretty drippy. So when Lucas's boss was driving home and he saw one of his old customers at the Sunoco station instead, he stopped and asked him how come he wasn't at his Gulf station. And the jerk told him he couldn't stand to have a guy with no legs wheel himself out in the rain all that time just to pump gas, and so he'd decided to go to the Sunoco station. Lucas got fired the next morning. "We can't be losing our most dependable customers," his stupid ex-boss said. The second time was from the A&P, when Lucas had to hold on to the edge of a display to shove some oranges high up, and the stupid edge broke off in his hand. You can imagine what happened to all the oranges. His boss fired him right there, with all the oranges around him. He wouldn't even give him his salary, because who was going to pay for all those stupid ruined oranges? The third time was from the Bank of the Catskills, where Lucas was a teller for a whole 2.5 hours on a Saturday morning until Mrs. Ruthke came in and asked him to deposit 3 checks and to cash the 4th, and he cashed the wrong one, she said. She complained loudly enough that the manager came over, and Lucas explained that he had cashed the one she had asked him to cash, and he was already fixing the problem,
and Mrs. Ruthke said she wasn't going to be lied about by the likes of him, and she had heard what soldiers did in Vietnam, and he was probably so drug-addled that he couldn't take proper directions from anyone, and how was someone like that to be trusted in a bank? And it wasn't a bank's business to take up hard luck cases like him. At least, not a bank that she would care to put her money into. Lucas didn't even wait. He wheeled himself out of the bank. Christopher was supposed to meet him after work to get him down the stairs out front, but Lucas decided he would take them himself. At the bottom, he wouldn't let anyone help him back into the chair. He told Christopher it took him half an hour. It was probably longer than that. I guess he wasn't actually fired from that job. I guess he quit. Sort of. When I got back from New York City that night, Lucas was alone in the living room watching some John Wayne Western where John Wayne was riding horses and climbing over fences and walking that way he walks. The television was the only thing on in the room. At the first commercial, I asked him how things were going. "Swell," he said. I asked him how work was. He told me. We left all the lights off so that I couldn't see that he was crying. If Mrs. Ruthke had been there, I would have punched her right in the face. The play was going to open at the Rose Theater in New York City on the last Friday of May. That week, you would have thought that Lil was blasting off to the moon, she was that nervous. She had stomach aches almost every day. She missed two of her advanced algebra assignments, which had never happened before, even once. She forgot to read the first act of Our Town, which wasn't missing much, and I'm not lying. And she never even asked how I was doing on the Transcontinental Railroad in the United States, which, if she would have asked, I would have told her was going to get the Golden Spike Award, which she wouldn't have understood because, as you might remember, there's only one of us working on this report. During classes, she mostly held her stomach and chewed on her pencils. She bit all the erasers off and ate them. Then she gnawed on all the metal tips until they came off. Then she started in on the wood. There were yellow splinters all around her desk. Mrs. Verne said it was perfectly normal for an actress. When she played the tragic Jocasta, she had gone through three fountain pens. On that last Friday, Mr. Ferris set Clarence rocking on the lab table as soon as class started. "This is, if I am not mistaken, the day," he said. Lil turned red, then white, then red again. "Lil Spicer," said Mr. Ferris, "what little I know of biology suggests that neither the gum of the eraser, nor the tin of the metal top, nor the wood of the pencil shaft, nor the lead of the interior will do much for your digestive system." "I can't help it," she said. Mr. Ferris went over to her desk. He took the pencil from her hand and examined it. And since there wasn't much left, it wasn't a long examination. "Lil Spicer," he said, still looking at the pencil, "perhaps during today's experiment, you should allow Doug Swiatek to handle the more toxic chemicals." Lil nodded. Mr. Ferris went back to the front. "A few days ago," he said, "Apollo 10 descended to 8.4 miles above the lunar surface to practice a moon landing. The astronauts described the Earth as a tiny blue, brown, and white basketball suspended in the void of outer space. They said that the moon is pitted with holes, and that it is illumined clearly by Earth's reflected light. They said that some of the craters seemed to glow softly." He threw the pencil stub in the garbage can. "Lil Spicer," he said, "you and Doug Swiatek are doing something extraordinary in an extraordinary time.
You are the first Washington Irving Junior High School students to perform in a Broadway play. As far as I know, you are the first citizens from Marysville to perform in a Broadway play. There is no need to be nervous. He leaned forward over the lab table. The Apollo missions have already descended close to the moon's surface. And you two have already succeeded. If you could have seen Lil's smile. If you could have seen her relax into her chair. And if you could have seen my mother, in hat and white gloves, when she got into the Spicer's car to go see a Broadway play that her son was in. If you could have seen her. We recited Lil's lines together all the way down into New York City that afternoon. And even though she was so nervous that she had a stomachache again, she got every line right. Except Scatcherd. We stopped at a White Castle on the way down and ate about 2 dozen hamburgers. Lil gave me her onions, and I scraped my pickles onto her hamburger. But my mother and Mr. and Mrs. Spicer couldn't eat at all. They were too nervous, they said. And even Lil ate only one. At the theater, Mr. Gregory was, of course, waiting for us. He looked pretty nervous, too. He bundled us inside like we were 2 hours late instead of 2 hours early. He sent Lil into the dressing room so that she could start becoming Helen Burns. I didn't have to do anything. If you're off stage, you can shriek like an insane woman who has been locked in an attic for a great many years without looking like an insane woman who has been locked in an attic for a great many years. So I read Our Town. Terrific. While Lil got ready, and my mother and Mr. and Mrs. Spicer went for a walk in Times Square, because they couldn't bear to wait in the theater, they said. And besides, my mother had never seen Times Square. And that is why they were not around when Mr. Gregory came looking for them. "They're out for a walk," I said. His face looked like disaster. "What?" I said. Mrs. Windermere happened to make her theater appearance right then. Blue dress flouncing, a couple of 100 strands of pearls draped around her, an ivory cane that she didn't really need. "Gregory," she said, "this is the night." Mr. Gregory looked at her. "What's happened?" she said. "Come with me," he said. "What's going on?" I said. "Everything's fine," said Mrs. Windermere. "Sure." They were gone a long time. While I waited to see how fine everything was, I watched the theater fill up through this little hole in the stage wings. Mrs. Windermere said that she had never had a play open without a packed house, and it looked like she was going to keep her stats perfect. The Rose was filling up pretty fast, and it wasn't filling up with just anybody. I'm not lying. Mayor Lindsay came down the aisle, shaking hands with everyone who could reach him and smiling like this was a parade or something. And a little after him came Jimmy Stewart. Really, Jimmy Stewart, walking down and shaking hands, too, with those huge hands he has. Jimmy Stewart. But you know what? That was nothing. I saw my mother and Lil's parents come in and sit in the second row, and then Mr. Gregory going out to see them, and them all getting up and heading backstage, I guess to wish me and Lil good luck one more time. And then, right near where their seats were, guess who came in and sat down? Just sat down. Real easy. And crossed his legs and leaned back and looked up at the ceiling a couple of times and then turned around to someone and shook his hand and then turned around to someone else and took his program and signed it. You know who this was? Joe Pepitone.
I'm not lying. Joe Pepitone was sitting in the second row of the Rose Theater. Joe Pepitone. And you know what I was going to do?